Thank you so much for joining Really Specific Stories, Andrew. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Ah, it's great to be here. Thanks.
Now, the first question that I have for you, as is the case with every guest, is how did you first get into podcasts?
Well, that's interesting. Let me think back to the beginning of podcasting. I think I was definitely an internet radio listener before I was a podcast listener. Is that right? I mean, I was really into college radio. And I had a radio show in college, and I remember it was kind of a big deal. This would have been around 2001 or so. It was a big deal when somebody built a live stream for that radio station. You know, and at the time, I remember it feeling a little bit like, why is this necessary? You know, I mean, I got that you would be able to listen to it all over the world, but I still was just, I was just excited about broadcasting to the community. You know, but then I think shortly around that time, I did start to discover the power of internet radio. And I really loved streaming. And I still, to this day, you know, I'm a huge podcast listener, but I still listen to a lot of streaming internet radio, you know, and I love the liveness of it and the kind of randomness of it, you know, the unpredictability of it. But so I'm trying to think of like when podcasting really became a part of my life. You know, and I was, when I started The Organist, which is the podcast I produced for KCRW in Los Angeles. In the beginning, it started as a podcast and it ended as a podcast. I did it for about 10 years between, it ended around 2019 or 18, and I did it for about 8 years. And that whole time at the beginning, we were like, oh, well, we'll start as a podcast, but then eventually it'll be a radio show, you know, and like the best thing that could happen to us would be if KCRW liked it enough to then put us on the air. And then by the end, like podcasting had sort of hit its inflection point. And it was like, why would we want to be on the air? Like podcasting is the best place for it. This is all a very roundabout way of trying to get back to the beginning of podcasting for me, though. I mean, you know, I remember like buying a CD of This American Life, like best of a CD that they released when I was in, I can't remember, I was either in high school or maybe like early in college, you know, and it hadn't occurred to me, or I don't even know if you could back then. That would have been like around 99 or 2000, like probably not, right? They weren't releasing it as a podcast back then. So that's all to say that like, I was definitely in the wheelhouse of like wanting on-demand narrative audio in that way, but becoming a regular consumer, you know, there's no standout moment for me, really. It was just sort of this like messy digital ecosystem that I lived in, where I had like my old This American Life CD, and I had my, you know, streaming internet, and I had like MP3s that I would download and save on my computer, you know. And I think at a certain point, I just like was a relatively late adopter to the iPhone and realized that it was possibly convenient to do things that way. And then like kind of imperceptibly over time, that just got added into my consumption.
Wow, that's amazing. And I love that CDs came up. I don't think that's come up before. Brilliant.
Yeah, you don't have any elderly guests such as myself who can remember this. No, I'm just kidding. I'm sure you do.
No, there's a broad spread, lots of different histories and experience. It's fantastic. And what I love about that, you mentioned liveness, you mentioned producing and consumption, you mentioned college radio. There's a lot of different avenues to and through audio in your early experience leading up to today. So maybe a broader question, what is it about audio for you? What do you get out of interacting with audio, whether you're listening or speaking?
I think, you know, I've always been a reader and I've always loved reading books, but I've also always been interested in radio. And, you know, I remember I had access to a video camera when I was little, and I found, I don't know where it is now, but I found this recording that I made where I may have even left the lens cap on, you know, and I was just interested in making a little radio show with it. And I was like, I guess you could film stuff with this, but like, I like the audio recording part of it. And, you know, so I think there's something performative about it that appeals to me, but performative not in the visual sense. You know, I like the kind of like verbal performance of it. And, you know, I come from a family of playwrights, and so I think certainly there's an aspect of that where it felt like in line with that kind of like verbal dialogic art that I was, you know, I wouldn't say I was steeped in it, because it's not like we were sitting around talking about Isbin or anything like that. But, you know, certainly it was just like a natural fact of like what people in my family did, like my mom and my grandfather and my aunt. And then my dad was and still is very much interested in digital media and was sort of like an early adopter in various digital media innovations, you know, going back to the 70s. And so I think that those two interests combined for me in like, on the one hand, I had this sort of literary interest in audio as like a verbal art form that was like part and parcel of my interest in literature. And then on the other hand, I had this like kind of technical media oriented interest that grew out of a lot of my dad's interests, where, you know, he was like an early desktop publishing guy and like early cable TV producer. And he also produced like radical underground alternative TV and radio in the 70s and that movement in the US. So I think, you know, going back to as long as I can remember, my interest in radio kind of connected with all of those parts of my lineage.
Sounds like you have a very busy and creative family, at least in your childhood. And I'm interested in what you just said there about having a family of playwrights, but also this kind of intersection with technology. The fact that you left the lens cap on is super fascinating. What are some of your earliest personal memories, building on what you just said about the camera just then, with digital technology and writing?
I mean, another memory, fast forwarding a little bit from that, you know, I was probably like 6 or 7, maybe, when I was playing with that video camera with the lens cap on. You know, I think the next milestone that I can remember was I bought a 4-track tape recorder in high school. Or I say I bought it, you know, I think it was like I agitated for a grant from the Parental Philanthropic Fund. In other words, I got it as a gift, which that probably would have been like 1996 or thereabouts, maybe 97. And it had a tape. You recorded on tape. But it was like, I think at the time, I remember like the groovy thing about it was you could bounce tracks. So in other words, you could like, it was a 4-track, but you could bounce all of 4 tracks that you had recorded onto 1 track and then keep going. So it had that kind of infinite capability. And I don't know enough about the history of this stuff, but I think like for that to be on like a relatively cheap consumer device like that was exciting. You know, I would like record music with my friends, but I remember the thing that I really enjoyed doing was, again, like we would, I remember this one thing I made where it was like, there was a musical bed of, you know, I think I was playing drums and my friend playing guitar, but then I like spent the most time recording this kind of like spoken word, like surrealist comedic monologue over it. And so that to me, certainly, if you know, I'm sure it would be cringeworthy to hear, but not that far of a distance between that, doing that, like speaking in a kind of like, I hate the word artsy, you know, but this was self-consciously artistic, but also like funny and silly over music, you know, it's like what I did with the organist, you know. And then around that time, I was living in Southern California. I started hearing Joe Frank on KCRW, and you know, he was all the things that I've been saying to you thus far about the sort of like interest in radio's possibilities as this sort of like literary or like paraliterary kind of performative, but also really unlike anything I'd ever heard. And, you know, very much in line with the kind of work I wanted to do. And the thing that really drew me to podcasting was, you know, I think storytelling is not a euphemism, but it doesn't really capture the experience that I had listening to it. It was confounding, you know, and sometimes confrontational and sometimes, yeah, very mysterious and hilarious. And there certainly was a narrative to it sometimes, but sometimes it really also just felt like, you know, in the same way that I wouldn't call a conversation storytelling, you know, it was, and even though it was a monologue, it felt conversational. It felt really like it was exploiting the medium, in a way that I had never experienced before. You know, it was radio art. And I think that's what really hooked me more than anything else, even if I had already been sort of primed by these other factors in my life to be receptive to that kind of work.
I love that you bring up the word narrative, because this very podcast, in connecting with different participants in the tech fandom or tech podcasting community, it's about surfacing narratives in people's lives and telling that story here. But that's different from what you're describing in terms of literary or artistic audio in that sense. So how did you feel starting to express yourself through this medium, taking what you had learned, you know, from playwright relatives and in the practice of using different technologies at home and in your study? What was it like to be expressing yourself through this audio media?
You mean when I started The Organist?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, and I guess, you know, I guess I would put college radio in that lineage too, even if it was on a much smaller scale. Yeah. I mean, I think it was interesting trying to square radio and podcasting with my interest in literature, because I think radio has a, or whatever, audio, let's call it, has a reputation for being conversational, you know, and it's a well-deserved reputation. You know, I think the unit of radio is the voice and speech, and, you know, and even in the sort of most artificial sense of like a, you know, somebody reading an audio book, there's a sense of that performance as being conversational. You're talking to someone in a very physical, literal way. But I was intrigued by the kind of gray area in between the conversation and the narrative, I guess. And which is to say that, you know, it sounded conversational and it sounded musical. You know, there were all these other elements that were part of it, but ultimately it was doing a lot of the same things that the printed word did in terms of conveying information, in terms of like trying to hold the reader or listener's attention. And so I think for me, when I started, I was always in my mind, if not explicitly, you know, doing work around writers and poets and philosophers, you know, like talking to people like that and doing stories about them, but also just in the work itself, thinking about the tension between the print and audio and between speech and writing.
And when it comes to identity, you've mentioned that you write, you've mentioned that you consume and you produce audio. How do you reconcile or balance or consider all of these different things that you do? How much of your life would you consider writing versus audio? How do you consider yourself?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I think if you had asked me that question, like, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, I would have a very different answer. But in the last 5 or 10 years, I've been doing a lot more of my own work where The Organist I consider my own work, but also it was, my role there was very much like as a host, you know, where I would say today we're talking to Martin, you know, he's doing this interesting project. And then often I would just like throw to a producer, or, you know, I would sort of wrap, you know, whereas with the last 5 years, I've very much been, it's been my voice driving different stories that I've done. And I've done like 2 pretty challenging podcast radio pieces, and then 2 pretty challenging magazine stories, as well as writing a book. And I've been struck by how, you know, obviously when I was producing the radio stories, there's like a whole different set of considerations, a whole different set of tools. I was like, you know, I had my shotgun microphone and I was switching it out with my Omni, you know, depending on the situation. You know, I felt like a filmmaker in some ways. You know, it was very documentary and gathering all this tape and logging the tape. You know, it's like, practically speaking, it's different. But then at bottom, those distinctions did start to blur for me a little bit. And like when people ask me, or when I think now, like what I want to do in terms of pitching something, I'm often thinking about the story before I'm thinking about, like, is this going to be a radio pitch or a magazine pitch? And I think at a certain point, I have to, obviously, you have to think about those considerations, but I guess I'm like a little more agnostic now. And I don't know how to answer this question without sounding just like a bundle of contradictions, but it's all to say that, like, I think that there are obvious and significant differences in the approach that you need to take with these different media. But at the same time, I think for me, there's this like core activity of writing and of thinking and of reporting that really carries over and informs each other. And, you know, there's different affordances, and, you know, but I think in the same way that like writing for a literary journal versus writing for a newspaper, you know, there's different affordances. Like, I think that those distinctions can sometimes be more significant than like doing a podcast for a arts and culture magazine versus doing a essay for the arts and culture magazine, if that makes sense.
No, that definitely makes sense. And I'm really intrigued by what you said about how it's merging in your mind, or it's really the story that comes first, and then it might take the form of the medium that you decide and you consider those affordances down the line. Now, I'm aware of your book, and I think that's a very interesting thing to ask you about, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Writing a book is quite an undertaking. It's a huge effort. It's, I mean, putting together a podcast with any kind of storytelling elements is a feat in itself, you know, if you consider soundscapes or different participants that might be involved. But can you tell me about the experience of writing a book, putting your writing skills and your history and experience into a project like that? What was the experience like?
I mean, it's interesting just to stay on this theme of like comparing it to audio, because I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who is a very accomplished radio producer who's done like, you know, serialized work that has, you know, been the equivalent of like a 6-hour radio documentary about, you know, a very narrative, you know, hundreds of hours of tape, you know, like really involved. And he was like, oh, I can't believe, imagine writing a book. And I was like, really? Because like your 6-hour radio documentary, like surely you did at least as much reporting as I did. And like, you know, processing and writing and rewriting. And he was kind of demure, but I wasn't like blowing smoke. Like, I think that they are both, you know, I think there's like a cultural weight that gets put on the printed book that is in some ways arbitrary, you know? And I think if you think about like a cultural object, like any cultural object, they're equally capable of putting the same amount of kind of thought and rigor and care and writing into something like a podcast. And for me, like, I think I took lessons that I learned from making radio and applied them to the book in a lot of different ways. I mean, one way was just the reporting process of the kind of like, okay, like I have an idea, like there's sort of a question that's dogging me. And now I'm going to think of a structure to put, you know, that will sort of accommodate that idea to allow me to pursue it. And like, and also what's the structure that will allow me to kind of narrate it in a way that will be compelling to a reader and sort of pull them through so that we're getting the like thinky stuff, but then there's also kind of like scenes and narrative and, you know, who are the characters and all those questions, you know, and including that, like, okay, like what are the books I have to read? And then what do I do with the notes on that book? You know, it's the same way as going through tape. You know, I interviewed this person and if I have an interview with someone that I'm going to try to include in a narrative audio project, you know, usually the process is I interview them and then I write down like the parts of the interview immediately afterwards that felt the most exciting to me. And then I go back through and pull those selects column. And then basically those sit there, you know, and those aren't always the things that I use. And sometimes later I might need something else, but like generally speaking, like then I write around those selects, right? And it's like, okay, these are like the four great quotes that the person just sounds great. And they're saying something that is, you know, either in the service of what I'm trying to write about or it's surprising. And then that there's a kind of like structure that builds up around them. And I didn't write the book like that exactly, but certainly there were, you know, you read a book and there's like maybe four sentences from that 300-page book that are like the things that are going to be useful to you in how you're using it. Or, you know, you interview somebody for an hour or two and they say one thing and that's the thing, you know. So it's that same process of like metabolizing a tremendous amount of information, some of which you're generating through interviews and some of which you're finding in research. And then for the processing of it is sort of happening at these multiple registers where you're like literally processing it, right? Like you're like kind of like editing a transcript and pulling selects and making notes, but then you're also like writing drafts and trying things out and then rewriting drafts and moving things around. And, you know, that process felt very familiar to me, even if it was new at the same time.
So there was a lot of research evidently in that book, but how much of yourself do you put into your writing? The book as an example or other articles that you've written?
I mean, there's no rule about that, you know, and that's something that I've been thinking a lot about lately, you know, because there's this funny thing that's happened where, you know, I've had a career in media for, I don't know, since 2003. And it's really only in the last sort of 10 years or 5 years that I've been writing full time, I guess. And that's coincided with my kind of becoming comfortable identifying as a blind person or as a disabled person. And that reality means that my own experience is relevant, or it can be. And the book was the sort of like, you know, supercharged version of that, where it was, you know, it's a memoir, but it's a memoir that does go pretty deep into history and into, you know, reported lands and, you know, talking to lots of other people who have nothing to do with me, besides, you know, something about their experience might offer me some guidance as I figure out my place in the world of blindness. So, you know, so that's a specific answer for that book. But like, you know, I did a piece for the New Yorker about deaf-blind communication and an emerging tactile language called protactile. And I remember talking to my editor about that, about like how much of myself should be in that piece. And he was, you know, I can't remember the exact numbers he used, but he sort of like had a funny speculative percentage. You know, he's like, well, if this other piece you did, it was like 60-40 or 70-30, like this would maybe be like 90-10 or something. In other words, 90% reporting on this new language and this deafblind community. But like the reality is like there is some shared experience because the folks that I was talking about, that I was writing about, they were born deaf, but they have the same eye condition that I have in addition to that. So like it's a radically different experience, but there were a couple of moments where like I had a funny interaction with one of them who was sort of like, I know what you're doing, you know, like take that hat off. Like, you know, don't wear hats like that. I tried that too, to like, you know, and so it was worth including that, but there was no point in making the focus be on myself. So it's really like a, you know, and I think any writer has to make that call. If you're in a genre that allows for writing about yourself, sometimes it makes a lot of sense. Sometimes it's really useful just as like a tool. And sometimes you want to align yourself completely.
Thank you very much for sharing that personal element as well. And I think it's actually really interesting in the context of podcasting as a medium. You mentioned there the world of blindness or low vision, different conditions or experiences that people have. When it comes to podcasting, I think there would be an assumption out there that for people who do live with blindness or with low vision that, oh, podcasting would be all well and good because it's audio. But
yeah,
can you shed some light on that experience? Or like, what would you say about the experience of podcasts as a medium in terms of accessibility for people who are living with blindness or low vision?
It's interesting just thinking about sort of the original part of our conversation, talking about the sort of slippage between text and sound. And, you know, as I've become a screen reader user where I listen to most of the, if not all of the books ever, you know, I still have vision that I use to read with magnification, but almost always, if I'm going to read for any, you know, any, with any seriousness, you know, anything beyond like just looking at a text message or something, I'm listening to it. And I've noticed that in the past where I would really kind of be a little more precious about it, like I'm listening to a podcast at 1x and I'm going to think about how it's produced. You know, and I still do that and I still care about that, but I have gotten very fast in my listening, you know, like it takes a lot for me to slow it down. That's like a real badge of honor if I'm bringing you down to 1x. And so that's one thing that's changed, I would say. But yeah, like it's sort of like there's like a little bit of a flattening of media for me as a screen reader user, where like I've got my phone and like I want to read the news. And there's some situations where like listening to a hour long podcast at 2x or even faster is like the way to do that. And sometimes I'm just like listening to my screen reader read the newspaper at, you know, probably like 3 or 4x. I don't know, you know, it doesn't have the same measures, so I don't know exactly how to compare the speed. But I don't always pay attention to that difference. Like I'm obviously aware of, I'm in control of making the choice, but like it feels a little bit like opening the fridge and being like, do I want scrambled eggs or hard boiled eggs? You know? And like, sure, they taste different and that they're basically the same thing. In terms of accessibility, I mean, that's real. That there's a real advantage, I would say. Like, I mean, I don't know if there's an advantage, I guess. Let me think. I mean, I think you just know what you're getting. Like, there's always a chance that a website is going to be inaccessible, you know, or that like a article is not going to have headings, or it's going to, you know, the focus is going to jump. Like an annoying thing that screen readers tend to do is that like the focus will jump without warning. So like you'll be reading one sentence and then suddenly like focus will jump to like a dynamically inserted ad somewhere else on the page, and it'll take some work to like get back to where you were. You know, generally speaking, podcast apps can crash, but like, you know that you're going to be able to navigate it in a reliable way, and that, you know, it's audio first. So there's not going to be, you know, your screen reader is not going to crash. There's a sort of stability to it that I do think is appealing to a blind or low vision consumer. there's always a chance reading a newspaper with a screen reader, even if it is reliable that like the text is there and you can get it. You know, there might be an infographic, there might be a photo spread, and you know, it might have alt text, and that's fine, and the alt text might be good, you know, and you might get a description of the photo. But like a podcast, you know, as a hearing blind person, you know, you're going to get everything that that the mainstream consumer is going to get. And I think that is an important affordance and an important component to the experience that, I mean, it's sort of obvious, but also I think bears mentioning.
Linking to the case studies within this project, I heard your work or your guest appearance on Parallel with Shelley Brisbane, which was fantastic and shed a lot of light on your experiences in writing and in audio production. I'm interested in your experience as a guest. Obviously, you're being a guest participant on this podcast right now, but appearing on a tech podcast specifically, I'm interested to know about your experience on that, because you have a great background and experience in audio and writing, but that was a tech-specific show. And I'd like to know a little bit, what's your experience with digital technology broadly since that time that you mentioned in your childhood? And can you speak a little bit about what you enjoy or like about digital technology?
There's a chapter in my book that is about the unique relationship between disability and technology. And so my conversation with Shelley on Parallels was really centered around that research that I had done. And, you know, and I think a lot of the thinking that I've been doing my whole life around media, in terms of the stuff that we discussed, like about the sort of ways to tell stories in sound versus in print, you know, and you know, just even just working as a magazine editor, I did a lot of print production. And so, you know, I'm very familiar with technical details of that world. And then I became familiar with technical details of podcasts, radio production, you know, and so, and then when I entered the world of disability, I was sort of delighted to find that technological geekery is a really important component of disability culture and a sort of natural one. And I guess to put a finer point on it, it's this idea that if the world isn't built for you as a disabled person, you know, if your average device or tool might not be designed for somebody who's missing a limb or who, you know, has a sensory disability, you have to, in essence, become a hacker of sorts in order to DIY the world to be accessible to you. And so the chapter that I wrote in the book is a lot about this sort of, it talks about a lot of disabilities, but it's really specifically about the sort of grand tradition of blind hackery. That begins, you know, going back, you know, I would argue that Louis Braille was a hacker in a way, you know, like tinkering with tools to create a way of blind literacy. Braille is a technology. And going back even further than that, you know, all the way up to, you know, people, something I'm trying to write about right now is like what blind and disabled people are doing in the XR, you know, like augmented reality, mixed reality, virtual reality space.
Mm.
So yeah, like even if I'm not like necessarily like a subject matter expert, you know, and it's not, you know, most of the podcasts I'm going on are these sort of like more book podcasts or, you know, like I've definitely done the rounds in the last year, 6 months promoting the book. But, you know, it was a delight to talk to Shelley, not just because of the tech orientation, but also I think because she occupies a really unique space. Like I think the subhead of, or the like the tagline for her show is like a tech podcast with accessibility sprinkles or something like that, which is very much in line with like the way that I kind of see my work too, where I am not writing for a blind audience alone. I'm interested in, you know, in the same way that her tech podcast is interested in tech writ large. It's not like assistive tech, but you got the sprinkles in there because it's, you know, that does happen to be where my attention is for a lot of time, and because there's interesting things that the mainstream world can sort of learn from and benefit from an engagement with that more narrow niche idea.
Thank you for explaining that. And I'm interested in picking up on the point of that word memoir, because memoirs are written at a certain time of your life and they draw on all that experience leading up to a point. But what comes after that memoir? What are you still hoping to do or to learn or to achieve? Or where do you see your audio and writing and production going from here?
Yeah, I mean, it's a memoir with an asterisk for sure, because like, yeah, I am not just in terms of what I've done with my life, but even if it's a memoir of blindness, you know, I'm still going blind. And So I didn't feel like I had the experience that I would want to write the sort of full stop, like, this is what it's like to lose your sight. And the memoir is very much a memoir of being in that liminal space. And as we discussed, it's also a memoir that does a tremendous amount of other kinds of work and includes a lot of other kinds of writing that are very carefully woven together with the memoir. You know, so it is journalism and it is criticism and history as well. And you know, and that mode, accounting for some calibration of, you know, a little bit more from column A, a little bit less from column B, you know, is a mode that I find really productive. And, you know, I think it's really exciting, you know, and I think a lot of writers take a similar approach where whether it's like every story of yours has to be about that, maybe not, but like, you know, I think Shelley's idea of accessibility sprinkled, or, you know, there's another blind writer I like named Ryan Knighton, who talked about blindness being not necessarily always a subject for him, but it's a perspective. And, you know, I think a lot of writers and audio producers have a similar approach, right? Where like you might have a different part of your identity. You know, you might, you know, have a particular religious background or be from a particular community or ethnicity or, you know, immigration status or whatever. You know, it's not like every story you do has to be about immigration, but like that and to some degree, that experience might inform your reporting and writing and, you know, give you access to certain communities that you want to write about or give you a perspective on certain stories, like different angles that somebody without that experience wouldn't have. And so that's the sort of approach that I want to take, where like, I don't want to only ever write disability stories, produce disability stories for the rest of my life. But at the moment, I feel like there's not, you know, there are a lot of disabled reporters doing really great work, but, you know, on balance, I think there's definitely room for more, you know, so I feel like there's a place for me there, you know, as opposed to like, if I just wanted to write about books or something, that's a lot much more crowded field, right? Or if I just wanted to be a tech reporter, that's a much more crowded field. But like these stories aren't being pitched as much, you know, and I think they're not being told as much. And I think they're really, really important. And, you know, I do think I have access in a way that feels really exciting. And it feels like a gift that I can do this kind of work and get people interested in it who might not think that they have any interest in this realm. So, yeah. So going forward, I want to continue to do that kind of work, you know, whether the first person element is 70% or 2%, you know, I think that'll have to depend on what the story is, but that's my path at the moment.
I think it's fantastic the way you frame it as a perspective, and it is that point in your life that you're sharing. Now, I'm aware that you've been very generous with your time. So is there anything that I haven't asked you or that we haven't been able to cover that you would like to talk about from your career or your experience before we end this episode?
Let me think. I think we hit it all. Yeah, I think we can leave it there.
Well, I really appreciate your time in joining me for this podcast episode today and sharing so much of your personal experience and thoughts on audio, writing, and all of your creative production. Thank you for spending time on really specific stories today.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah, I'm excited to see what comes of your research. It sounds fascinating.